As an example, the more precisely you know where a particle is, the less precisely you can possibly know its speed. Similarly, the more precisely you know how fast a particle is moving, the less you can possibly know about where it is. Quantum theory thereby sets up its own duality. You can determine with precision certain physical features of the microscopic realm, but in so doing you eliminate the possibility of precisely determining certain other complementary features. To understand why, let's follow a rough description developed by Heisenberg himself, which, while incomplete in particular ways that we will discuss, does give a useful, intuitive picture. When we measure the position of any object, we generally interact with it in some manner. If we search for the light switch in a dark room, we know we have located it when we touch it. If a bat is searching for a field mouse, it bounces sonar off its target and interprets the reflected wave. The most common instance of all is locating something by seeing it, by receiving light that has reflected off the object and entered our eyes. The key point is that these interactions not only affect us, but also affect the object whose position is being determined. Even light, when bouncing off an object, gives it a tiny push. Now, for day-to-day objects, such as this book or a clock on the wall, the wispy little push of bouncing light has no noticeable effect. But when it strikes a tiny particle like an electron, it can have a big effect. As the light bounces off the electron, it changes the electron's speed, much as your own speed is affected by a strong, gusty wind that whips around a street corner. In fact, the more precisely you want to identify the electron's position, the more sharply defined and energetic the light beam must be, yielding an even larger effect on the electron's motion. This means that if you measure an electron's position with high accuracy, you necessarily contaminate your own experiment. The act of precision position measurement disrupts the electron's velocity. You can therefore know precisely where the electron is, but you cannot also know precisely how fast at that moment it was moving. Conversely, you can measure precisely how fast an electron is moving, but in so doing you will contaminate your ability to determine with precision its position. Nature has a built-in limit on the precision with which such complementary features can be determined. And although we are focusing on electrons, the uncertainty principle is completely general. It applies to everything. In day-to-day life, we routinely speak about things like a car passing a particular stop sign, position, while traveling at 90 miles per hour, velocity, blithely specifying these two physical features. In reality, quantum mechanics says that such a statement has no precise meaning since you can't ever simultaneously measure a definite position and a definite speed. The reason we get away with such incorrect descriptions of the physical world is that on everyday scales, the amount of uncertainty involved is tiny and generally goes unnoticed. Heisenberg's principle does not just declare uncertainty, it also specifies, with complete certainty, the minimum amount of uncertainty in any situation. If we apply his formula to your car's velocity just as it passes a stop sign whose position is known to within a centimeter, then the uncertainty in speed turns out to be just shy of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a mile per hour. A state trooper would be fully complying with the laws of quantum physics if he asserted that your speed was between 89.9 followed by 34 nines, and 90.0 followed by 33 zeros and a 1 miles per hour as you blew past the stop sign. So much for a possible uncertainty principle defense. But if we were to replace your massive car with a delicate electron, whose position we knew to within a billionth of a meter, then the uncertainty in its speed would be a whopping 100,000 miles per hour. uncertainty is always present. But it becomes significant only on microscopic scales. The explanation of uncertainty as arising through the unavoidable disturbance caused by the measurement process has provided physicists with a useful intuitive guide as well as a powerful explanatory framework in certain specific situations. However, it can also be misleading. It may give the impression that uncertainty arises only when we lumbering experimenters meddle with things. This is not true. Uncertainty is built into the wave structure of quantum mechanics and exists whether or not we carry out some clumsy measurement. As an example, take a look at a particularly simple probability wave for a particle, the analog of a gently rolling ocean wave. Since the peaks are all uniformly moving to the right, you might guess that this wave describes a particle moving with the velocity of the wave peaks. Experiments confirm that supposition. But where is the particle? Since the wave is uniformly spread throughout space, there is no way for us to say the electron is here or there. When measured, it literally could be found anywhere. So, while we know precisely how fast the particle is moving, there is huge uncertainty about its position. And, as you see, this conclusion does not depend on our disturbing the particle. We never touched it. Instead, it relies on a basic feature of waves. They can be spread out. Although the details get more involved, similar reasoning applies to all other wave shapes, so the general lesson is clear. In quantum mechanics, uncertainty just is. Einstein, uncertainty, and a question of reality. An important question, and one that may have occurred to you, is whether the uncertainty principle is a statement about what we can know about reality, or whether it is a statement about reality itself. Do objects making up the universe really have a position and a velocity, like our usual classical image of just about everything? A soaring baseball, a jogger on the boardwalk, a sunflower slowly tracking the sun's flight across the sky. Although quantum uncertainty tells us these features of reality are forever beyond our ability to know simultaneously, even in principle? Or does quantum uncertainty break the classical mold completely, telling us that the list of attributes our classical intuition ascribes to reality, a list headed by the positions and velocities of the ingredients making up the world, is misguided? Does quantum uncertainty tell us that, at any given moment, particles simply do not possess a definite position and a definite velocity? To Bohr, this issue was on par with a Zen koan. Physics addresses only things we can measure. From the standpoint of physics, that is reality. Trying to use physics to analyze a deeper reality, one beyond what we can know through measurement, is like asking physics to analyze the sound of one hand clapping. But in 1935, Einstein, together with two colleagues, Boris Podolsky and Nathan Rosen, raised this issue in such a forceful and clever way that what had begun as one hand clapping reverberated over 50 years into a thunderclap that heralded a far greater result in our understanding of reality than even Einstein ever envisioned. The intent of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper was to show that quantum mechanics, while undeniably successful at making predictions and explaining data, could not be the final word regarding the physics of the microcosmos. Their strategy was simple, and was based on the issues just raised. They wanted to show that every particle does possess a definite position and a definite velocity at any given instant of time. And thus they wanted to conclude that the uncertainty principle reveals a fundamental limitation of the quantum mechanical approach. If every particle has a position and a velocity, but quantum mechanics cannot deal with these features of reality, then quantum mechanics provides only a partial description of the universe. quantum mechanics, they intended to show, was therefore an incomplete theory of physical reality, and, perhaps, merely a stepping stone toward a deeper framework waiting to be discovered. In actuality, as we will see, they laid the groundwork for demonstrating something even more dramatic: the non-locality of the quantum world. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, EPR, were partly inspired by Heisenberg's rough explanation of the uncertainty principle. When you measure where something is, you necessarily disturb it, thereby contaminating any attempt to simultaneously ascertain its velocity. Although, as we have seen, quantum uncertainty is more general than the disturbance explanation indicates, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen invented what appeared to be a convincing and clever end run around any source of uncertainty. What if, they suggested, you could perform an indirect measurement of both the position and the velocity of a particle in a manner that never brings you into contact with the particle itself? For instance, using a classical analogy, imagine that Rod and Todd Flanders decide to do some lone wandering in Springfield's newly formed nuclear desert. They start back-to-back in the desert center and agree to walk straight ahead, in opposite directions, at exactly the same prearranged speed. Imagine further that, 9 hours later, their father, Ned, returning from his trek up Mount Springfield, catches sight of Rod, runs to him, and desperately asks about Todd's whereabouts. Well, by that point, Todd is far away. But by questioning and observing Rod, Ned can nevertheless learn much about Todd. If Rod is exactly 45 miles due east of the starting location, Todd must be exactly 45 miles due west of the starting location. If Rod is walking at exactly 5 miles per hour due east, Todd must be walking at exactly 5 miles per hour due west. So, even though Todd is some 90 miles away, Ned can determine his position and speed, albeit indirectly. Einstein and his colleagues applied a similar strategy to the quantum domain. There are well-known physical processes whereby two particles emerge from a common location with properties that are related in somewhat the same way as the motion of Rod and Todd. For example, if an initial single particle should disintegrate into two particles of equal mass that fly off back to back, like an explosive shooting off two chunks in opposite directions, something that is common in the realm of subatomic particle physics, the velocities of the two constituents will be equal and opposite. Moreover, the positions of the two constituent particles will also be closely related. And for simplicity, the particles can be thought of as always being equidistant from their common origin. An important distinction between the classical example involving Rod and Todd and the quantum description of the two particles is that, although we can say with certainty that there is a definite relationship between the speeds of the two particles, if one were measured and found to be moving to the left at a given speed, then the other would necessarily be moving to the right at the same speed, we cannot predict the actual numerical value of the speed with which the particles move. Instead, the best we can do is use the laws of quantum physics to predict the probability that any particular speed is the one attained. Similarly, while we can say with certainty that there is a definite relationship between the positions of the particles, if one is measured at a given moment and found to be at some location, the other necessarily is located the same distance from the starting point, but in the opposite direction, we cannot predict with certainty the actual location of either particle. Instead, the best we can do is predict the probability that one of the particles is at any chosen location. Thus, while quantum mechanics does not give definitive answers regarding particle speeds or positions, it does, in certain situations, give definitive statements regarding the relationships between the particle speeds and positions. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen sought to exploit these relationships to show that each of the particles actually has a definite position and a definite velocity at every given instant of time. Here's how. Imagine you measure the position of the right-moving particle, and in this way learn, indirectly, the position of the left-moving particle. EPR argued that since you have done nothing, absolutely nothing, to the left-moving particle, it must have had this position, and all you have done is determine it, albeit indirectly. They then cleverly pointed out that you could have chosen instead to measure the right-moving particle's velocity. In that case, you would have indirectly determined the velocity of the left-moving particle without at all disturbing it. Again, EPR argued that since you would have done nothing, absolutely nothing, to the left-moving particle, it must have had this velocity, and all you would have done is determine it. Putting both together, the measurement that you did and the measurement that you could have done, EPR concluded that the left-moving particle has a definite position and a definite velocity at any given moment. As this is subtle and crucial, let me say it again. EPR reasoned that nothing in your act of measuring the right-moving particle could possibly have any effect on the left-moving particle, because they are separate and distant entities. The left-moving particle is totally oblivious to what you have done, or could have done, to the right-moving particle. The particles might be meters, kilometers, or light-years apart when you do your measurement on the right-moving particle. So, in short, the left-moving particle couldn't care less what you do. Thus, any feature that you actually learn or could in principle learn about the left-moving particle from studying its right-moving counterpart must be a definite, existing feature of the left-moving particle, totally independent of your measurement. And since, if you had measured the position of the right particle, you would have learned the position of the left particle, and if you had measured the velocity of the right particle, you would have learned the velocity of the left particle, it must be that the left-moving particle actually has both a definite position and velocity. Of course, this whole discussion could be carried out interchanging the roles of left-moving and right-moving particles. And in fact, before doing any measurement, we can't even say which particle is moving left and which is moving right. This leads to the conclusion that both particles have definite positions and speeds. Thus, EPR concluded that quantum mechanics is an incomplete description of reality. Particles have definite positions and speeds, but the quantum mechanical uncertainty principle shows that these features of reality are beyond the bounds of what the theory can handle. If, in agreement with these and most other physicists, you believe that a full theory of nature should describe every attribute of reality, the failure of quantum mechanics to describe both the positions and the velocities of particles means that it misses some attributes and is therefore not a complete theory. It is not the final word. That is what Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen vigorously argued. The quantum response. While EPR concluded that each particle has a definite position and velocity at any given moment, notice that if you follow their procedure, you will fall short of actually determining these attributes. I said above that you could have chosen to measure the right-moving particle's velocity. Had you done so, you would have disturbed its position. On the other hand, had you chosen to measure its position, you would have disturbed its velocity. If you don't have both of these attributes of the right-moving particle in hand, you don't have them for the left-moving particle either. Thus, there is no conflict with the uncertainty principle. Einstein and his collaborators fully recognized that they could not identify both the location and the velocity of any given particle. But, and this is key, even without determining both the position and velocity of either particle, EPR's reasoning shows that each has a definite position and velocity. To them, it was a question of reality. To them, a theory could not claim to be complete if there were elements of reality that it could not describe. After a bit of intellectual scurrying in response to this unexpected observation, the defenders of quantum mechanics settled down to their usual pragmatic approach, summarized well by the eminent physicist Wolfgang Pauli. One should no more rack one's brain about the problem of whether something one cannot know anything about exists all the same than about the ancient question of how many angels are able to sit on the point of a needle. Physics in general, and quantum mechanics in particular, can deal only with the measurable properties of the universe. Anything else is simply not in the domain of physics. If you can't measure both the position and the velocity of a particle, then there is no sense in talking about whether it has both a position and a velocity. EPR disagreed. Reality, they maintained, was more than the readings on detectors. It was more than the sum total of all observations at a given moment. When no one, absolutely no one, no device, no equipment, no anything at all is looking at the moon, they believed, the moon was still there. They believed that it was still part of reality. In a way, this standoff echoes the debate between Newton and Leibniz about the reality of space. Can something be considered real if we can't actually touch it or see it, or in some way measure it? In Chapter 2, I described how Newton's bucket changed the character of the space debate, suddenly suggesting that an influence of space could be observed directly in the curved surface of spinning water. In 1964, in a single stunning stroke that one commentator has called the most profound discovery of science, the Irish physicist John Bell did the same for the quantum reality debate. In the following four sections, we will describe Bell's discovery, judiciously steering clear of all but a minimum of technicalities. All the same, even though the discussion uses reasoning less sophisticated than working out the odds in a craps game, it does involve a couple of steps that we must describe and then link together. Depending on your particular taste for detail, there may come a point when you just want the punchline. If this happens, feel free to jump past these four sections, where you'll find a summary and a discussion of conclusions stemming from Bell's discovery. Bell and spin. John Bell transformed the central idea of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper from philosophical speculation into a question that could be answered by concrete experimental measurement. Surprisingly, all he needed to accomplish this was to consider a situation in which there were not just two features, for instance, position and velocity, that quantum uncertainty prevents us from simultaneously determining. He showed that if there are three or more features that simultaneously come under the umbrella of uncertainty, three or more features with the property that in measuring one, you contaminate the others and hence can't determine anything about them, then there is an experiment to address the reality question. The simplest such example involves something known as spin. Since the 1920s, physicists have known that particles spin. Roughly speaking, they execute rotational motion akin to a soccer ball's spinning around as it heads toward the goal. But a number of essential features are missed by this classical image, and foremost for us are the following two points. First, particles, for example electrons and photons, can spin only clockwise or counterclockwise at one never-changing rate about any particular axis. A particle's spin axis can change directions, but its rate of spin cannot slow down or speed up. Second, quantum uncertainty applied to spin shows that just as you can't simultaneously determine the position and the velocity of a particle, so also you can't simultaneously determine the spin of a particle about more than one axis. For example, If a soccer ball is spinning about a northeast pointing axis, its spin is shared between a northward and an eastward pointing axis. And by a suitable measurement, you could determine the fraction of spin about each. But if you measure an electron's spin about any randomly chosen axis, you never find a fractional amount of spin. Ever. It's as if the measurement itself forces the electron to gather together all its spinning motion and direct it to be either clockwise or counterclockwise about the axis you happened to have focused on. Moreover, because of your measurement's influence on the electron's spin, you lose the ability to determine how it was spinning about a horizontal axis, about a back-and-forth axis, or about any other axis prior to your measurement. These features of quantum mechanical spin are hard to picture fully, and the difficulty highlights the limits of classical images in revealing the true nature of the quantum world. But the mathematics of quantum theory, and decades of experiment, assure us that these characteristics of quantum spin are beyond doubt. The reason for introducing spin here is not to delve into the intricacies of particle physics. Rather, the example of particle spin will, in just a moment, provide a simple laboratory for extracting wonderfully unexpected answers to the reality question. That is, does a particle simultaneously have a definite amount of spin about each and every axis, although we can never know it for more than one axis at a time because of quantum uncertainty? Or does the uncertainty principle tell us something else? Does it tell us, contrary to any classical notion of reality, that a particle simply does not and cannot possess such features simultaneously? Does it tell us that a particle resides in a state of quantum limbo, having no definite spin about any given axis, until someone or something measures it, causing it to snap to attention and attain, with a probability determined by quantum theory, one particular spin value or another, clockwise or counterclockwise, about the selected axis? By studying this question, essentially the same one we asked in the case of particle positions and velocities, we can use spin to probe the nature of quantum reality, and to extract answers that greatly transcend the specific example of spin. Let's see this. As explicitly shown by the physicist David Bohm, the reasoning of Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen can easily be extended to the question of whether particles have definite spins about any and all chosen axes. Here's how it goes. Set up two detectors capable of measuring the spin of an incoming electron, one on the left side of the laboratory and the other on the right side. Arrange for two electrons to emanate back-to-back from a source midway between the two detectors, such that their spins, rather than their positions and velocities, as in our earlier example, are correlated. The details of how this is done are not important. What is important is that it can be done, and in fact, can be done easily. The correlation can be arranged so that if the left and right detectors are set to measure the spin along axes pointing in the same direction, they will get the same result. If the detectors are set to measure the spin of their respective incoming electrons about a vertical axis, and the left detector finds that the spin is clockwise, so will the right detector. If the detectors are set to measure spin along an axis 60 degrees clockwise from the vertical, and the left detector measures a counterclockwise spin, so will the right detector. And so on. Again, in quantum mechanics, the best we can do is predict the probability that the detectors will find clockwise or counterclockwise spin. But we can predict with 100% certainty that whatever one detector finds, the other will find too. To avoid linguistic complications, I'm describing the electron spins as perfectly correlated, even though the more conventional description is one in which they're perfectly anti-correlated. Whatever result one detector finds, the other will find the opposite. To compare with the conventional description, Imagine that I've interchanged all the clockwise and counterclockwise labels on one of the detectors. Bohm's refinement of the EPR argument is now, for all intents and purposes, the same as it was in the original version that focused on position and velocity. The correlation between the particles' spins allows us to measure indirectly the spin of the left-moving particle about some axis by measuring that of its right-moving companion about that axis. Since this measurement is done far on the right side of the laboratory, it can't possibly influence the left-moving particle in any way. Hence, the latter must all along have had the spin value just determined. All we did was measure it, albeit indirectly. Moreover, since we could have chosen to perform this measurement about any axis, the same conclusion must hold for any axis. The left-moving electron must have a definite spin about each and every axis, even though we can explicitly determine it only about one axis at a time. Of course, the roles of left and right can be reversed, leading to the conclusion that each particle has a definite spin about any axis. At this stage, seeing no obvious difference from the position-velocity example, you might take Pauli's lead and be tempted to respond that there is no point in thinking about such issues. If you can't actually measure the spin about different axes, what is the point in wondering whether the particle, nevertheless, has a definite spin, clockwise versus counterclockwise, about each? Quantum mechanics, and physics more generally, is obliged only to account for features of the world that can be measured. And neither Bohm, Einstein, Podolsky, nor Rosen would have argued that the measurements can be done. Instead, they argue that the particles possess features forbidden by the uncertainty principle, even though we can never explicitly know their particular values. Such features have come to be known as hidden features, or more commonly, hidden variables. Here is where John Bell changed everything. He discovered that even if you can't actually determine the spin of a particle about more than one axis, still, if in fact it has a definite spin about all axes, then there are testable, observable consequences of that spin. Reality testing. To grasp the gist of Bell's insight, let's return to Mulder and Scully and imagine that they've each received another package, also containing titanium boxes, but with an important new feature. Instead of having one door, each titanium box has three, one on top, one on the side, and one on the front. The accompanying letter informs them that the sphere inside each box now randomly chooses between flashing red and flashing blue when any one of the box's three doors is opened. If a different door, top versus side versus front, on a given box were opened, the color randomly selected by the sphere might be different. But once one door is opened and the sphere has flashed, there is no way to determine what would have happened had another door been chosen. In the physics application, this feature captures quantum uncertainty. Once you measure one feature, you can't determine anything about the others. Finally, the letter tells them that there is again a mysterious connection, a strange entanglement, between the two sets of titanium boxes. Even though all the spheres randomly choose what color to flash when one of their boxes' three doors is opened, if both Mulder and Scully happen to open the same door on a box with the same number, the letter predicts that they will see the same color flash. If Mulder opens the top door on his box 1 and sees blue, then the letter predicts that Scully will also see blue if she opens the top door on her box 1. If Mulder opens the side door on his box 2 and sees red, then the letter predicts that Scully will also see red if she opens the side door on her box 2, and so forth. Indeed, when Scully and Mulder open the first few dozen boxes, agreeing by phone which door to open on each, they verify the letter's predictions. Although Mulder and Scully are being presented with a somewhat more complicated situation than previously, at first blush it seems that the same reasoning Scully used earlier applies equally well here. "Mulder," says Scully, "this is as silly as yesterday's package. Once again, there is no mystery. The sphere inside each box must simply be programmed. Don't you see?"
"But now there are three doors," cautions Mulder, "so the sphere can't possibly know which door we'll choose to open, right?"
"It doesn't need to," explains Scully. "That's part of the programming. Look, here's an example. Grab hold of the next unopened box, box 37, and I'll do the same. Now, imagine, for argument's sake, that the sphere in my box 37 is programmed, say, to flash red if the top door is opened, to flash blue if the side door is opened, and to flash red if the front door is opened. I'll call this program Red, Blue, Red. Clearly, then, if whoever is sending us this stuff has input this same program into your box 37, and if we both open the same door, we will see the same color flash. This explains the mysterious connection. If the boxes in our respective collections, with the same number, have been programmed with the same instructions, then we will see the same color if we open the same door. There is no mystery." But Mulder does not believe that the spheres are programmed. He believes the letter. He believes that the spheres are randomly choosing between red and blue when one of their boxes' doors is opened, and hence he believes fervently that his and Scully's boxes do have some mysterious, long-range connection. Who is right? Since there is no way to examine the spheres before or during the supposed random selection of color, remember, any such tampering will cause the sphere instantly to choose randomly between red or blue, confounding any attempt to investigate how it really works. It seems impossible to prove definitively whether Scully or Mulder is right. Yet, remarkably, after a little thought, Mulder realizes that there is an experiment that will settle the question completely. Mulder's reasoning is straightforward, but it does require a touch more explicit mathematical reasoning than most things we cover. It's definitely worth trying to follow the details. There aren't that many. But don't worry if some of it slips by. We'll shortly summarize the key conclusion. Mulder realizes that he and Scully have so far only considered what happens if they each open the same door on a box with a given number. And, as he excitedly tells Scully after calling her back, there is much to be learned if they do not always choose the same door, and instead randomly and independently choose which door to open on each of their boxes. "Mulder, please, just let me enjoy my vacation. What can we possibly learn by doing that?" "Well, Scully, we can determine whether your explanation is right or wrong." "Okay, I've got to hear this." "It's simple," Mulder continues. "If you're right, then here's what I realized. If you and I separately and randomly choose which door to open on a given box and record the color we see flash, then, after doing this for many boxes, we must find that we saw the same color flash more than 50% of the time. But if that isn't the case, if we find that we don't agree on the color for more than 50% of the boxes, then you can't be right." "Really, how is that?" Scully is getting a bit more interested. "Well," Mulder continues, "here's an example. Assume you're right, and each sphere operates according to a program. Just to be concrete, imagine the program for the sphere in a particular box happens to be blue, blue, red. Now, since we both choose from among three doors, there are a total of 9 possible door combinations that we might select to open for this box. For example, I might choose the top door on my box, while you might choose the side door on your box. Or I might choose the front door, and you might choose the top door, and so on." "Yes, of course," Scully jumps in. "If we call the top door 1, the side door 2, and the front door 3, then the 9 possible door combinations are just 1-1, 1-2, 1-3, 2-1,
22-23-31-32-33. Yes, that's right, Mulder continues. Now here is the point. Of these nine possibilities, notice that five door combinations, 11-22-33, 12-21, will result in us seeing the spheres in our boxes flash the same color. The first three door combinations are the ones in which we happen to choose the same door. And as we know, that always results in our seeing the same color. The other two door combinations, 12 and 21, result in the same color because the program dictates that the spheres will flash the same color, blue, if either door 1 or 2 is opened. Now, since 5 is more than half of 9, this means that for more than half, more than 50% of the possible combination of doors that we might select to open, the spheres will flash the same color. But wait, Scully protests. That's just one example of a particular program, blue, blue, red. In my explanation, I propose that differently numbered boxes can and generally will have different programs. Actually, that doesn't matter. The conclusion holds for all of the possible programs. You see, my reasoning with the blue, blue, red program only relied on the fact that two of the colors in the program are the same. And so an identical conclusion follows for any program. Red, red, blue, or red, blue, red, and so on. Any program has to have at least two colors the same. The only programs that are really different are those in which all three colors are the same, red, 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 and blue, blue, blue. But for boxes with either of these programs, we'll get the same color to flash regardless of which doors we happen to open. And so the overall fraction on which we should agree will only increase. So, if your explanation is right, and the boxes operate according to programs, even with programs that vary from one numbered box to another, we must agree on the color we see more than 50% of the time. That's the argument. The hard part is now over. The bottom line is that there is a test to determine whether Scully is correct, and each sphere operates according to a program that determines definitively which color to flash depending on which door is opened. If she and Mulder independently and randomly choose which of the three doors on each of their boxes to open, and then compare the colors they see, box by numbered box, they must find agreement for more than 50% of the boxes. When cast in the language of physics, as it will be in the next section, Mulder's realization is nothing but John Bell's breakthrough. Counting Angels with Angles. The translation of this result into physics is straightforward. Imagine we have two detectors, one on the left side of the laboratory and another on the right side, that measure the spin of an incoming particle like an electron, as in the experiment discussed in the section before last. The detectors require you to choose the axis, vertical, horizontal, back, forth, or one of the innumerable axes that lie in between, along which the spin is to be measured. For simplicity's sake, imagine that we have bargain basement detectors that offer only three choices for the axes. In any given run of the experiment, you will find that the incoming electron is either spinning clockwise or counterclockwise about the axis you selected. According to Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, each incoming electron provides the detector it enters with what amounts to a program. Even though it's hidden, even though you can't measure it, EPR claimed that each electron has a definite amount of spin, either clockwise or counterclockwise, about each and every axis. Hence, when an electron enters a detector, the electron definitively determines whether you will measure its spin to be clockwise or counterclockwise about whichever axis you happen to choose. For example, an electron that is spinning clockwise about each of the three axes provides the program clockwise, clockwise, clockwise. An electron that is spinning clockwise about the first two axes and counterclockwise about the third provides the program clockwise, clockwise, counterclockwise, and so forth. in order to explain the correlation between the left-moving and right-moving electrons, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen simply claim that such electrons have identical spins and thus provide the detectors they enter with identical programs. Thus, if the same axes are chosen for the left and right detectors, the spin detectors will find identical results. Notice that these spin detectors exactly reproduce everything encountered by Scully and Mulder, though with simple substitutions. Instead of choosing a door on a titanium box, we are choosing an axis. Instead of seeing a red or blue flash, we record a clockwise or counterclockwise spin. So, just as opening the same doors on a pair of identically numbered titanium boxes results in the same color flashing, choosing the same axes on the two detectors results in the same spin direction being measured. Also, just as opening one particular door on a titanium box prevents us from ever knowing what color would have flashed had we chosen another door, measuring the electron spin about one particular axis prevents us, via quantum uncertainty, from ever knowing which spin direction we would have found had we chosen a different axis. All of the foregoing means that Mulder's analysis of how to learn who's right applies in exactly the same way to this situation as it does to the case of the alien spheres. If EPR are correct, and each electron actually has a definite spin value about all three axes, if each electron provides a program that definitively determines the result of any of the three possible spin measurements, then we can make the following prediction. Scrutiny of data gathered from many runs of the experiment, runs in which the axis for each detector is randomly and independently selected, will show that, more than half the time, the two electron spins agree, being both clockwise or both counterclockwise. If the electron spins do not agree more than half the time, then Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen are wrong. This is Bell's discovery. It shows that even though you can't actually measure the spin of an electron about more than one axis, even though you can't explicitly read the program it is purported to supply to the detector it enters, this does not mean that trying to learn whether it nonetheless has a definite amount of spin about more than one axis is tantamount to counting angels on the head of a pin. Far from it. Bell found that there is a bona fide, testable consequence associated with a particle having definite spin values. By using axes at three angles, Bell provided a way to count Pauli's angels. No smoke, but fire. In case you missed any of the details, let's summarize where we've gotten. Through the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, quantum mechanics claims that there are features of the world, like the position and the velocity of a particle, or the spin of a particle about various axes, that cannot simultaneously have definite values. A particle, according to quantum theory, cannot have a definite position and a definite velocity. A particle cannot have a definite spin, clockwise or counterclockwise, about more than one axis. A particle cannot simultaneously have definite attributes for things that lie on opposite sides of the uncertainty divide. Instead, particles hover in quantum limbo, in a fuzzy, amorphous, probabilistic mixture of all possibilities. Only when measured is one definite outcome selected from the many. Clearly, this is a drastically different picture of reality than that painted by classical physics. Ever the skeptic about quantum mechanics, Einstein, together with his colleagues, Podolsky and Rosen, tried to use this aspect of quantum mechanics as a weapon against the theory itself. EPR argued that even though quantum mechanics does not allow such features to be simultaneously determined, particles nevertheless do have definite values for position and velocity. Particles do have definite spin values about all axes. Particles do have definite values for all things forbidden by quantum uncertainty. EPR thus argued that quantum mechanics cannot handle all elements of physical reality. It cannot handle the position and velocity of a particle. It cannot handle the spin of a particle about more than one axis, and hence is an incomplete theory. For a long time, the issue of whether EPR were correct seemed more a question of metaphysics than of physics. As Pauli said, if you can't actually measure features forbidden by quantum uncertainty, what difference could it possibly make if they nevertheless exist in some hidden fold of reality? But remarkably, John Bell found something that had escaped Einstein, Bohr, and all the other giants of 20th century theoretical physics. He found that the mere existence of certain things, even if they are beyond explicit measurement or determination, does make a difference. A difference that can be checked experimentally. Bell showed that if EPR were correct, the results found by two widely separated detectors measuring certain particle properties, spin about various randomly chosen axes, in the approach we have taken, would have to agree more than 50% of the time. Bell had this insight in 1964, but at that time the technology did not exist to undertake the required experiments. By the early 1970s it did. Beginning with Stuart Friedman and John Clauser at Berkeley, followed by Edward Fry and Randall Thompson at Texas A&M, and culminating in the early 1980s with the work of Alain Aspect and collaborators working in France, ever more refined and impressive versions of these experiments were carried out. In the Aspect experiment, for example, the two detectors were placed 13 meters apart, and a container of energetic calcium atoms was placed midway between them. Well-understood physics shows that each calcium atom, as it returns to its normal, less energetic state, will emit two photons traveling back-to-back, whose spins are perfectly correlated, just as in the example of correlated electron spins we have been discussing. Indeed, in Aspect's experiment, whenever the detector settings are the same, the two photons are measured to have spins that are perfectly aligned. If lights were hooked up to Aspect's detectors to flash red in response to a clockwise spin and blue in response to a counterclockwise spin, the incoming photons would cause the detectors to flash the same color. But, and this is the crucial point, when Aspect examined data from a large number of runs of the experiment, data in which the left and right detector settings were not always the same, but rather were randomly and independently varied from run to run, he found that the detectors did not agree more than 50% of the time. This is an earth-shattering result. This is the kind of result that should take your breath away. But just in case it hasn't, let me explain further. Aspect's results show that Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen were proven by experiment, not by theory, not by pondering, but by nature, to be wrong. And that means there has to be something wrong with the reasoning EPR used to conclude that particles possess definite values for features, like spin values about distinct axes, for which definite values are forbidden by the uncertainty principle. But where could they have gone wrong? Well, remember that the Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen argument hangs on one central assumption. If, at a given moment, you can determine a feature of an object by an experiment done on another, spatially distant object, then the first object must have had this feature all along. Their rationale for this assumption was simple and thoroughly reasonable. Your measurement was done over here, while the first object was way over there. The two objects were spatially separate, and hence your measurement could not possibly have had any effect on the first object. More precisely, since nothing goes faster than the speed of light, if your measurement on one object were somehow to cause a change in the other, for example, to cause the other to take on an identical spinning motion about a chosen axis, there would have to be a delay before this could happen. A delay at least as long as the time it would take light to traverse the distance between the two objects. But in both our abstract reasoning and in the actual experiments, the two particles are examined by detectors at the same time. Therefore, whatever we learn about the first particle by measuring the second must be a feature that the first particle possessed, completely independent of whether we happened to undertake the measurement at all. In short, the core of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument is that an object over there does not care about what you do to another object over here. But, as we just saw, this reasoning leads to the prediction that the detectors should find the same result more than half the time, a prediction that is refuted by the experimental results. We are forced to conclude that the assumption made by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, no matter how reasonable it seems, cannot be how our quantum universe works. Thus, through this indirect but carefully considered reasoning, the experiments lead us to conclude that an object over there does care about what you do to another object over here. That is, even though quantum mechanics shows that particles randomly acquire this or that property when measured, the randomness can be linked across space. Pairs of appropriately prepared particles don't acquire their measured properties independently. They are like a pair of magical dice, one thrown in Atlantic City and the other in Las Vegas, each of which randomly comes up one number or another, yet the two of which somehow manage always to agree. Such particles act similarly, except they require no magic. Such particles, even though spatially separate, do not operate autonomously. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen set out to show that quantum mechanics provides an incomplete description of the universe. Half a century later, theoretical insights and experimental results inspired by their work require us to turn their analysis on its head and conclude that the most basic, intuitively reasonable, classically sensible part of their reasoning is wrong. The universe is not local. The outcome of what you do at one place can be linked with what happens at another place, even if nothing travels between the two locations, even if there isn't enough time for anything to complete the journey between the two locations. Einstein's, Podolsky's, and Rosen's intuitively pleasing suggestion that such long-range correlations arise merely because particles have definite, pre-existing, correlated properties is ruled out by the data. That's what makes this all so shocking. In 1997, Nicolas Gissin and his team at the University of Geneva carried out a version of the aspect experiment in which the two detectors were placed 11 kilometers apart. The results were unchanged. On the microscopic scale of the photon's wavelengths, 11 kilometers is gargantuan. It might as well be 11 million kilometers, or 11 billion light-years, for that matter. There is every reason to believe that the correlation between the photons would persist, no matter how far apart the detectors are placed. This sounds totally bizarre. But there is now overwhelming evidence for this so-called quantum entanglement. If two photons are entangled, the successful measurement of either photon's spin about one axis forces the other, distant photon, to have the same spin about the same axis. The act of measuring one photon compels the other, possibly distant photon, to snap out of the haze of probability and take on a definitive spin value, a value that precisely matches the spin of its distant companion. And that boggles the mind. Entanglement and special relativity, the standard view. I have put the words forces and compels in quotes, because while they convey the sentiment our classical intuition longs for, their precise meaning in this context is critical to whether or not we are in for even more of an upheaval. With their everyday definitions, these words conjure up an image of volitional causality. We choose to do something here so as to cause or force a particular something to happen over there. If that were the right description of how the two photons are interrelated, special relativity would be on the ropes. The experiments show that from the viewpoint of an experimenter in the laboratory, at the precise moment one photon's spin is measured, the other photon immediately takes on the same spin property. If something were traveling from the left photon to the right photon, alerting the right photon that the left photon's spin had been determined through a measurement, it would have to travel between the photons instantaneously. That would conflict with the speed limit set by special relativity. The consensus among physicists is that any such apparent conflict with special relativity is illusory. The intuitive reason is that even though the two photons are spatially separate, their common origin establishes a fundamental link between them. Although they speed away from each other and become spatially separate, their history entwines them. Even when distant, they are still part of one physical system. And so it's really not that a measurement on one photon forces or compels another distant photon to take on identical properties. Rather, the two photons are so intimately bound up that it is justified to consider them, even though they are spatially separate, as parts of one physical entity. Then we can say that one measurement on this single entity, an entity containing two photons, affects the entity. That is, it affects both photons at once. While this imagery may make the connection between the photons a little easier to swallow, as stated, it's vague. What does it really mean to say two spatially separate things are one? A more precise argument is the following. When special relativity says that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, the nothing refers to familiar matter or energy. But the case at hand is subtler, because it doesn't appear that any matter or energy is traveling between the two photons, and so there isn't anything whose speed we are led to measure. Nevertheless, there is a way to learn whether we've run headlong into a conflict with special relativity. A feature common to matter and energy is that when traveling from place to place, they can transmit information. Photons traveling from a broadcast station to your radio carry information. Electrons traveling through internet cables to your computer carry information. So, in any situation where something, even something unidentified, is purported to have traveled faster than light speed, a litmus test is to ask whether it has, or at least could have, transmitted information. If the answer is no, the standard reasoning goes, then nothing has exceeded light speed, and special relativity remains unchallenged. In practice, this is the test that physicists often employ in determining whether some subtle process has violated the laws of special relativity. None has ever survived this test. Let's apply it here. Is there any way that, by measuring the spin of the left-moving and the right-moving photons about some given axis, we can send information from one to the other? The answer is no. Why? Well, the output found in either the left or the right detector is nothing but a random sequence of clockwise and counterclockwise results. Since, on any given run, there is an equal probability of the particle to be found spinning one way or the other. In no way can we control or predict the outcome of any particular measurement. Thus, there is no message, there is no hidden code, there is no information whatsoever in either of these two random lists. The only interesting thing about the two lists is that they are identical. but that can't be discerned until the two lists are brought together and compared by some conventional, slower-than-light means. Fax, email, phone call, etc. The standard argument thus concludes that although measuring the spin of one photon appears instantaneously to affect the other, no information is transmitted from one to the other, and the speed limit of special relativity remains in force. Physicists say that the spin results are correlated, since the lists are identical, but do not stand in a traditional cause and effect relationship, because nothing travels between the two distant locations. Entanglement and special relativity, the contrarian view. Is that it? Is the potential conflict between the non-locality of quantum mechanics and special relativity fully resolved? Well, probably. On the basis of the above considerations, the majority of physicists sum it up by saying there is a harmonious coexistence between special relativity and aspects results on entangled particles. In short, special relativity survives by the skin of its teeth. Many physicists find this convincing, but others have a nagging sense that there is more to the story. At a gut level, I've always shared the coexistence view, but there is no denying that the issue is delicate. At the end of the day, no matter what holistic words one uses, or what lack of information one highlights, two widely separated particles, each of which is governed by the randomness of quantum mechanics, somehow stay sufficiently in touch so that whatever one does, the other instantly does too. And that seems to suggest that some kind of faster-than-light something is operating between them. Where do we stand? There is no ironclad, universally accepted answer. Some physicists and philosophers have suggested that progress hinges on our recognizing that the focus of the discussion so far is somewhat misplaced. The real core of special relativity, they rightly point out, is not so much that light sets a speed limit, as that light speed is something that all observers, regardless of their own motion, agree upon. More generally, these researchers emphasize, the central principle of special relativity is that no observational vantage point is singled out over any other. Thus, they propose, and many agree, that if the egalitarian treatment of all constant velocity observers could be squared with the experimental results on entangled particles,